My name is Winnie Eddy, and I think I'm a very grateful member of Al-Anon. I have to keep my gratitude on a day-to-day basis because I'm not always grateful. But it helps a lot to take your glasses off. I don't know how many are out there. I'm not always grateful because I'm a prepared loser. I know how to handle misery a little bit better than I do gratitude because I've been miserable most of my life. And it wasn't until I came to Al-Anon and they kept trying to feed me this gratitude that I began to realize I've been miserable, you know. I mean, I thought everybody was. But I always get a little nervous when I talk in front of a group where there are a lot of AA members because I have a great respect for Alcoholics Anonymous in general and alcoholics in particular. And so I always give them fair warning. I don't know whether I'm going to have any kind of a message for you today or not. I was talking down in Fontana one time, and after the meeting, a girl came up to me, and she asked me where I was going to be talking the next time, and I said, well, I'm not sure. Why? And she said, well, I would very much like to have my husband hear you. So immediately I figured, well, I must have said something, and I better find out what it is. So I just quietly asked her, well, do you think I could help your husband? And she said, well, not really, but after he hears you, he's going to be glad he got me. So that may be the only message that the alcoholic takes from this meeting. But there's that word again, gratitude. I try to follow when I quit shaking, I kind of settle down after a while, if you can wait that long. But I try to follow the formula that Al-Anon gives us in helping one another, which is telling a little bit about what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. However, in my particular case, I'm going to tell you a little bit about what I used to be like, what happened, and let you guess. Because I don't want to make any rash statements. This, I believe, is the first time that my husband has ever heard me give a full pitch, unless it was outside the door and he was listening. Because he's always told me he wasn't well enough to go through it twice. But since I've released him, and out of the corner of my eye, I noticed he hasn't missed a bite, so I'm not going to worry about it. I only have one story, and there are some people that have heard it many, many times. But I wouldn't change it if I could, because I'm one of those people that had to go almost as far as the alcoholic before I was ready for help. It is a lot harder to help the non-alcoholic, as you'll find out, because there was nothing wrong with me. You see, I grew up in a family where there was a drinking problem. My father was an alcoholic, and when I came to Al-Anon, I used to be able to spot alcoholics 2 miles away. You know, anybody that was going into a bar, coming out of a bar, standing in front of a liquor store, just looking strange, to me was an alcoholic. And I was used to strange people and the things that they did. And in growing up, my father didn't do anything. Well, he didn't deprive me. He didn't beat me. He didn't do any of the things that I suppose happened in a lot of families. But he didn't have to, because it wasn't necessarily what my father did that bothered me. It was what my father didn't do that bothered me. You see, I wanted my father to be the father. I wanted him to do all the things that I thought a father ought to do. And when we'd have family picnics or something like that, you know, which was usually on some kind of a big holiday, my father was never there. Of course, my father's a golf professional, or at least he was, and when everybody else was playing, he was out earning a living, but I didn't take that as an excuse, you know, because this didn't fit in with my plans. Now, it made my life pretty miserable, because when I was at school, I could never be honest about my father. I could be honest about my mother, about my brothers, about my sister, but never my father. I always described him not as he was, but the way I wished he was, sort of a composite picture of all the good things that I thought a father ought to be. Now, I'd never been a father, but I had a lot of ideas. And, of course, it made my life miserable because no one could go home with me. Because if they did, they were going to find out one of two things. Right now, the man that was living with my mother was not my father, or that I was the biggest liar that ever came down the pike. Now, I never considered myself a liar. I looked upon myself as a diplomat because I didn't lie. I just didn't tell the truth. And I thought there was a difference because, you see, I learned at a very early age that people anticipate what you're going to say. And so if you just lead them up to a certain point and stop, they usually guess what you would have said if you'd have gone on. And they're very poor guessers. But, of course, I have trouble with that sometimes today because since my husband's been sober and taking kind of an interest in my welfare, which is to say he's not so interested in me getting lost as he used to be, he sometimes volunteers to go with me if I'm going to be talking at a meeting that's quite a ways away. And this is a test of serenity, you know, because I happen to be married to the original don't know where he is when he leaves, don't know where he is when he gets there, and don't know where he's been when he gets back. But if he goes with me, he directs me every step of the way, you know. And, of course, as I say, this is a test of serenity because by the time you get to where you're going, you look like the newcomer instead of the speaker. because we're at opposite ends of the pole when it comes to being anything alike. I happen to be married to a thinker. Sometimes he thinks 2-3 weeks, you know, before he gives you an answer, which is easily explained. Since he's given up drinking, he's taken up dusting, which is almost as bad as drinking. And we were playing golf one day. I happened to look over, and he was dusting the golf cart, and I thought, this is really, you know. So when I got back in the cart, I nearly said to him, when you die, I'm going to bury you in a plastic bag. And he didn't say anything, so I didn't say anything. And about 2 weeks later, we were having a cup of coffee, and out of a clear blue sky, he said, I don't think that was very nice. So this is the type people we are. He thinks, and I react immediately. You know, I try to get it done before you tell me what you want me to do, which does lead to some problems. But anyhow, when we're going together, it's kind of a trial. And I happened to be going down to Chula Vista, and I just couldn't face going that far with him. So I merely said, I'm going to a meeting. You know, and he didn't ask me where, and I didn't tell him. But when I got home that night, it wasn't 10:30 or 10:45. It was more like 1:45. And when I walked through the door, there he stood in my appointed spot with that age-old question, where the hell have you been, you know? And without thinking, I said, well, how far do you think it is to Chula Vista? Now, he thought I lied to him. I didn't lie to him. I didn't tell him I wasn't going to Chula Vista. And if he'd asked me, I was willing to tell him. He just didn't ask me, you know. So why should I be held responsible for his mistake? And that's the way I operated. Now, my father did have one little habit that kind of carried over into later years. That was sleeping on the living room floor. Now, it wasn't that he liked sleeping on the living room floor. It was just the way it worked out, you know. He'd come home and he'd sit down, then he'd lean down, then he'd lay down. And that meant he was good for the night. And my mother, being the type person she was, said, that's his business. You tend to your business and we shouldn't have any problems. So I used to step over him and go about my business. But I should have stepped on him because he bothered me on that living room floor. And when I got one of my own that used to pick peculiar places to sleep, I didn't care if he was on the porch or the lawn. I would have preferred something like Century Boulevard about this time, because he had a double indemnity clause in his insurance. But I couldn't stand him on the living room floor. And I can remember to this day taking him by the heels and pulling him, you know, and his head had bounced. I loved it when his head bounced. There was something about that thud that made me feel good deep down inside, because I wanted to hurt him the way I thought he was trying to hurt me. I didn't know then that he couldn't, if he had tried, hurt me as badly as I hurt myself. I don't know what happened to the man that I met, fell in love with, and permitted to marry me. which is a battle that's still going on, but it doesn't make any difference how it happened. We deserved one another before it was over with. But he was in the Navy. He was a full lieutenant. He was a professional man. And as soon as he was mine, I decided to help him. I wanted to help him become what I knew he wanted to be for my sake. I'm not well enough to define that for you, but it'll give you something to think about on the way home. But I didn't go into this blindly. I did a little reading about the Navy, and even in those days, I had the attitude of sticking with the winners, so I read about people like John Paul Jones and Admiral Perry. I even let a few Englishmen get in there because it looked pretty good. And I suddenly decided that I would help him become an admiral. Now, I knew they only had one admiral in the dental corps, but I only had one man in mind for the job. It didn't look so difficult. However, if I had been smart, I would have joined the Navy myself because I showed up every day. They never had to worry about me. I was there. But he only showed up when the spirit moved him, which wasn't too often. And, of course, when I'd show up and find out that he hadn't shown up, that's when I used to hunt for him. Now, I would have made a marvelous shore patrolman because even with a head start, he didn't get away from me too often. However, sometimes when I'd find him, he was in no shape for me to let anybody else find him. And so that's when I had to hide him, you know. We played a game of hide-and-seek for years, but he didn't know the game was going on. But, of course, after he came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had to help him with the program because I wasn't sure he was bright enough to get what they were willing to give him. And so I would go to the meetings with him, and I would take notes about the things that particularly pertain to his peculiar case, and then I'd sort of remind him during the week, you know. And I heard two things that I want you to know almost drove me up a wall. One of them was sleep teaching. You know, I got myself a big book, and every night as he would be going to sleep, I would open it to chapter 5, and I would read to him. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our paths, you know. It didn't do a thing for him, but I almost had insomnia from it because I couldn't go to sleep. And I think sometimes it's the reason when we're at a meeting outside our own area, for some reason or other, it's always me they come up to, and they'll say, keep coming back because it'll work, you know. They think I'm the alcoholic. But the other thing I heard was that you can't get drunk if you're grateful. And, of course, in Al-Anon, they discourage you making any reference to don't drink. You know, so I had to find something to put in there instead so that I could work the program and so forth. So I used to say, be grateful. And he'd go out to the office in the morning, and I'd say, remember, today, be grateful. And he'd say, for what? And it got to be kind of a game with us, I guess. But I finally remembered this game of hide-and-seek, and so one day I said to him, you know, when you used to drink quite a bit, I found it necessary on occasion to hide you. And sometimes I had to put you in some strange places, but I never lost you, so be grateful. And I did put him, or help him get into some strange places. And the one that I usually mention, because I don't know, it brings back and points out so many things about me, happened down here at the Navy Yard. They had a mock submarine just inside the sentry gate, and I came across my husband in front of this mock submarine with his six-pack of beer at the exact moment that I spotted his commanding officer coming from the opposite direction. Well, I just told that man one of my better stories, so I had to get rid of him. And the only place I had to put him was in that submarine. Now, getting him in wasn't too hard. I just helped him up and he fell down. But getting him out was a horse of another color because he wouldn't give me the beer. Because, you see, when I came to Al-Anon, I had one of the greatest pitching arms in the business. I could throw a full six-pack of beer farther than he had strength enough to retrieve it. So if I was around and he had a six-pack of beer, he'd hold it like Joe Namath trying to win the Super Bowl, you know. But I have many times wondered what that sentry must have thought of that female half in, half out of the conning tower, that damn thing, finally coming up with this lieutenant commander holding his beer and his hat. He didn't know he was going up or down. Because I used to go on that base like I owned it in my house coat and my curlers. Because I don't think the alcoholic realizes what we have to give up in order to help them, you know. In my particular case, it was dressing. Because you have a choice, you know. You can always go to bed in what you're going to wear tomorrow, but it just doesn't seem to work out. But I have never ceased to be amazed how far they can get while you're combing your hair. It's one of those unsolvable problems, but I had the opportunity of talking at the naval base. It's sort of God's way of helping me make amends. He keeps sending me back to these places that I've infected so I can confess. And in the group that night, there was a man, and after the meeting, he came up and he said, "Winnie, if you ever get nostalgic, come on down and I'll take you through that submarine, because it was one of my favorite drinking places." And do you know, that fast, my mind went back 20 years, and I thought, what would I have done if I'd have reached down and come up with the wrong one, you know? Because I was in no mood for surprises at that particular point in my development. But I suppose that a lot of you know how I felt when he came home after, I'm not sure how long, I used to be able to tell you right to the hour, that he was in the Navy and announced that he had resigned. I was like somebody that had lost a business, you know. I was beginning to realize that making an admiral out of him was a little more difficult than I had anticipated, but that's what he was in. When he was out, I didn't know what to do with him, you know. And he had worried me for a long time. Now, I can honestly say I never blamed the drinking. I blamed the places he drank, the people he drank with, and the way he drank. He didn't drink like normal people, me, you know, because for years I was the only normal human being on earth. And I used to make it a great point to start on, say, Wednesday, if we happened to be going to a cocktail party on Friday or Saturday, convincing him that we could come home that night. We did not have to stay until Monday. You know, it was just one of those things. And I think, and this is just my opinion, but I think that at the moment that he became addicted to alcohol, I became addicted to him. Because I used to like to drink. I enjoyed the cocktail parties. I enjoyed the Navy round of type of life. But as his drinking increased, mine decreased. Because, you see, I couldn't drink and keep track of him. And keeping track of him was more important to me than anything else. So while I was trying to figure out what I was going to do with him, I happened to remember his mother. And I didn't like his mother. I didn't have any particular reason except she was his mother. But she always showed up at the wrong time, you know. I just get him grooved to where I knew what he was going to do. And I had my life pretty well organized. Start peeling the potatoes at 4:30, start looking for him at 5, catch up with him at 6, talk him into coming home at 7, you can eat at 8. Which worked out very well, except when his mother came to visit, he'd come home at 4:30. And, you know, I didn't know what to do with him because they still weren't going to eat till 8. It was one of my schedules. And so his mother didn't believe in drinking at all, and so it suddenly occurred to me this must be his problem. He hadn't been raised in a social drinking family such as mine. And so, evidently, he didn't know how to drink. So I decided to teach him. Have you ever tried to teach an alcoholic how to drink? You have one big problem. You've got to get him sober enough to find out if he's learning anything that you're teaching him. So in order to do that, I decided that we'd leave California, because I hated California. To me, it was one large bar separated by an occasional liquor store, you know. And I used to wonder, what do these people do if they get a headache? You know, I'd never seen a drugstore. Of course, I never stopped to realize in those days that I never went anyplace unless I was looking for him. And he was always in A1 health. My chances of finding him in a drugstore are too remote to even go into. But I left California, and I had that nice, comfortable feeling that you get when you've solved one of your problems, you know. And Of course, the first mistake we made, we stopped in Gallup, New Mexico. And I spent three of the most miserable days of my life in Gallup, New Mexico, because he got into a bar that I was afraid to follow him into. Now, from where I was sitting, he and a tribe of Indians went in. And I know what Indians and Firewater do when they get together, and I wasn't going to get massacred in that godforsaken place, so I sat outside and waited. Never dawned on me there was a back door. You know, he went in the front door, out the back door, wherever he wanted to go, in the back door, out the front door, and there was Old Faithful spouting right where he left her. And, of course, I always like to mention there was a little Indian squaw standing right in front of this place. And I mention her because I think she was my first contact with that certain something that we have in Al-Anon. In AA, they call it the unspoken language, but in Al-Anon, I think it's the language of the heart. Because this is the only place in my life that I've ever been where I can feel what people are saying. I don't have to hear them. And sometimes they don't even have to talk. And I looked over at this little gal this first morning, and I was embarrassed for her. You know, to think that she would allow herself to be degraded by standing in front of a place like that. Of course, I'm across the street making peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for five children, but she looked strange to me. But the second day, she looked pretty good, and the third day, I kind of waved, you know, because she had her side of the street and I had mine. But, of course, while I was there, I had to make one of my many decisions. Some darn fool had told me that Texas had dry counties, and so that's the decision I'd made. I would never again stop where the human race could contaminate my husband. Now, if you're going across country in an automobile and you don't intend to stop, you have to make adjustments. And that's where these dry counties came in. Of course, whoever it was that told me forgot to say that they put one dry one between two wetlands. And I damn near never got out of Texas, you know, because I wouldn't stop unless I was in a dry county. Now, it didn't make any difference because he got just as drunk in the dry ones as he would in the wet one. But if you're going crazy on a slow, easy plan, this helps. Because you can spend hours wondering, where did he get it? I don't know where he got it. I know today that if I had locked him in a closet, he'd have come out drunk. I just know it, that's all. But my kids think Texas the biggest place on earth. Of course, it took us almost 2 weeks to get through it. And it was sort of an unwritten law. If she stops and you got anything to do, get out, get it done, and get back, or she'll never miss you. And that's about the way it was, because, you see, I concentrated on that seat. And if he was in it, we went. And if he wasn't, we waited. And I thank God today, as I have many other days, that he saw fit to take care of those children. Because, you see, I didn't look behind me. I knew it was back there. And thank God that when I got where I was going, they were there. But anyhow, we finally got to Harrisburg, Illinois, which I more or less directed us to with great thought, you know, because my mother-in-law had become involved with the WCTU, and I figured what's a better place to teach an alcoholic how to drink than underneath the nose of the Women's Christian Temperance Union. And so I had one of those nice, comfortable feelings that you get again. And, of course, the next morning when Eddie asked me could he take the car down and have it serviced, because this is one thing about my husband. He always asked my permission before he did as he damn pleased. But I had the car keys, the money, the checkbook, the credit card, I had everything. And I didn't want him to think I didn't trust him. So I allowed him, you know, go right ahead and take the car. And you know how he repaid me? He came back drunker than I'd ever seen him before. Now, I had no quarrel with the fact that alcoholism is a progressive disease, because my husband was always drunker than I'd ever seen him before. A couple of times he protested his innocence, but, you know, when you see a man walk through the door in the morning and you say to yourself, that son of a gun will be drunk by tonight, so you don't wash the dishes, you don't make the beds, you don't sweep the floor, you don't do anything except plan how you're going to get even with him for what you know he's doing to you. Now, if he comes home sober and you admit it, you're crazy, you know, because he's the only excuse you got for the way the place looks. But on this particular day, he was pretty loaded, so While we were packing, which is a record I held when I came to Al-Anon, I used to be able to pack for 10 people in less time than it takes most people to make up their minds where they're going. But I didn't have that problem. But I happen to remember being a native-born Missourian that Kansas is a dry state. But don't you believe it. Everything they drink in Missouri, they must haul over from Kansas. Because we were there less time than we were in Illinois until he'd found a bar within walking distance, because naturally, I took the car away from him, just like you would any other 10-year-old child you're taking care of. And he used to walk down to this place every single solitary day. And I'd say, why? And he'd say, well, the bartender likes to talk to me, you know, as though that's like waving a red flag in front of a bull. But it did tickle me after he came to AA. He told one time about having to pass a Catholic church on the way down to this place. I happen to be Catholic, but he's not. But he took the time one day to go into that church, light a candle, and say a prayer for me. And then he saw a sign that said the candle cost a quarter, and he didn't want to spend a quarter, so he blew it out. I've never had nerve enough to ask him, was he praying for me or against me, but that's about the time the fun really started. Now, in my opinion, and that's all I'm offering you today, is the way I think and the way I feel. I speak only for myself. But in my opinion, the non-alcoholic is by far sicker than the alcoholic. Because you take a drunk to a meeting and you get him sober, and right now you can see the difference. But you take somebody like me, perfect. Never did anything that I couldn't explain if I had enough time. Devoted my life and my ambitions to my family, to my community, and in particular to my husband. Tell me that I'm sick. How can you be sick and do what I did? You know, tell me I have to change. How are you going to improve on perfect? You know? And that's what I was when I came to Al-Anon. Oh, I was miserable, but I was perfectly miserable. You know, it was one of those things. Plus the fact that if for some reason or other Eddie quit drinking, I would immediately start going over everything I'd said, every place we'd been, everything we'd done, trying to figure out what did I do to stop him. And while I'm trying to figure out what I do to stop him, he starts again. Which means that now I got to figure out what I do to start him, so if I ever stop him, I'll never start him again, you know. Over and over again, because I always took the blame for getting him drunk and the credit for getting him sober. It never dawned on me that he had any part in it whatsoever. But he quit drinking all of a sudden right there in Kansas, and I had decided to help him become a millionaire. And a little voice deep down inside of me told me I had about 2 weeks and I'd better get busy. So went down, picked out a nice unsuspecting town in the state of Missouri that needed a dentist. Talked to a man in Kansas City, a friend of my father's who unfortunately for him was in the dental supply business. Talked that man into giving me $17,000 worth of dental equipment. I had the most beautiful dental office you've ever seen. I even had patients. But I had no dentist, because he had found the one place I overlooked when I canvassed that town, and that was a bar called Blondie's, you know, because he always went into these exotic places. I finally quit saying, you know, in my prayers, I didn't say, please make him stop drinking. I said, let him go to the Hilton one, you know, because it's embarrassing to go into some of these dens where you can't even tell which one belongs to you. And they all look the same from the back. But he was only out of that office and in, or out of that bar and in that office once, to the best of my recollection. And that was when a man came in that I decided to help. And so I went down to Blondie's. And I don't know about you, but I used to take on kind of a crazy Hattie look, you know. My hair could stand right straight up on end, and my eyes came out about like this. And I'd just dare him not to do something, and he's not all that brave, and usually he'd do it. And so he went back to the office with me, and as we walked in, this guy said, now listen, Doc, I'm allergic to Novocaine, but I got my own anesthesia. So he took a bottle out of his pocket, and he had a drink, and the dentist had a drink. They pulled the tooth, and then they both went back to Blondie. And as far as I'm concerned, that's what saved that town. because I made up my mind I wouldn't help them. You know, they just didn't deserve my help. And yet I'm grateful today, as I have been for a long, long time. The drunk as he was, sick as he was, he never allowed me to push him beyond a certain point. This was part of my frustration. I could get him to do almost everything. But in this particular area, he wouldn't be pushed. And I'm glad, because if he had worked on the people in that town in the condition he was in, he could have made so many mistakes that I never would have lived long enough to make the amends, and they would have been my amends. Because, you see, I looked upon this office as a symbol of success. I spent a lifetime thinking that success was out there someplace, that it was something you invited people over to, or something that you wore, or something that you drove around the block in. I didn't know until I came to Al-Anon that for me, success is inside. Success to me today is being able to get up in the morning, walk into the bathroom, look in the mirror, and know who I am. To be so contented with me on a one-day-at-a-time basis that I don't have to strive to control anybody out there so that I look good. But anyhow, when I left California, I had 5 children. I have 8 altogether. Maybe I should say we. And you have to kind of count them as they creep in, just like I did, because I was always surprised, you know. Of course, I found out not so awful long ago that it was nothing to the surprise that he had when he sobered up and counted them. But anyhow, I hadn't been to see a doctor because having had 5, I didn't really think I needed to go, and besides that, I wasn't. But it was getting kind of close to the time. So I went up to Kansas City to see a doctor, and I don't know whether you realize it, being in the profession, but doctors are very happy people, you know. They're almost glad you're sick. And I went in to see this doctor, and he was a joy boy of the whole bunch, you know. He just patted me on the back the whole time. He was saying, "Mrs. Eddy, you're going to have twins." I almost died in his office, you know, because I had problems. I had a dental office with no dentist plus 5, and that thing I didn't know what to do with. I wasn't really planning on 1, and he's insisting on 2. And besides, I knew what Eddie was going to say when I told him, because he said it. There's no twins in my family. I got so involved defending my moral character that I forgot there were twins in my family. Yeah. And it wasn't until after they had arrived that my mother said something like, "Isn't it nice we have another set of twins?" And I said, "Whose family?" She said, "Ours." I said, "Well, why didn't you tell me?" She said, "You didn't ask me, you know. But I'm happy to report we have another set. My daughter has a set of twin girls, and we have a ball with them. But we just accepted them. You know, when they came, they belonged to us, and we took them home." But, of course, at the appointed time, I went into the hospital, and here again, you know, I never realized how happy a hospital is. There's people that are happy they got there, people that are happy, everybody's happy. Well, I'd been happy once, and it hadn't worked out well, so I really didn't want what they had. So as soon as I was able, I had a phone put in, because that was my connection to the misery that I had left outside. And when I thought I was getting happy, I'd just pick up that phone, call the office. Now, I knew Eddie wasn't going to answer. I wasn't sure he knew there was a phone in there. But the point I'm trying to make is I don't need him to make me miserable. All I need is a little bit of time to think. Where is he? And who is he with? And what is he doing? While I lie here? 15 minutes you're having hysterics. The nurse don't know what happened to you. You haven't even had a visitor, and you look like you've been run over by a truck. Because I never thought of my husband being out with the boys. Never. Mine was always out with the girls. The pretty, sweet, lovable things, you know, like you find in every bar. The ones that looked like me before he did this. And if you're like me and you like to be right, just find yourself a mirror. You know, you look like something that was left over from a bad Halloween party.
Because contrary to the popular belief, being a martyr is not easy. It's hard. It's a 24-hour-a-day concentrated effort, or you don't get that look. You got to have circles down to here, and you twitch when you least expect it, which goes away after a while. But, you know, you got to really work at it. But anyhow, I had to make another decision, and I had a choice. I could either take a real quick postgraduate course in dentistry, or I had to close the office. And so, in as much as it looked like I was going to be busy with five plus that thing and two, I decided to close the office and we'd go to California, the land of sunshine and promise. Now, I had forgotten how miserable I'd been in California. Compared to how miserable I was in Missouri, California looked pretty good to me. And, of course, Eddie helped a great deal because he said, "Winnie, I have seen the light. I will never take another drink as long as I live." And I went right up on the roof. We made an adorable couple. He went on and off like a neon light, and I went up and down like a yo-yo. You couldn't have missed us. And, of course, when we got out here, we moved into the nicest place that we could find in Santa Monica, a place befitting a person of my stature. I couldn't afford it, but I was the only one that knew that. Which is a tip for anybody that's still working on it. If you like misery, just go out and buy something you can't afford. It gives you hours of pleasure while you wait for them to come take it back, you know. But I didn't stay in Santa Monica because I couldn't stand the people. They were the coldest-bloodedest people I have ever in my life been around. Now, I didn't know any of them, but you don't have to know them, you know. You can tell by the way they look at you, just what they're thinking, and so I moved. We went to Culver City, but I didn't stay there very long because I found out they were related to the people that live in Santa Monica. So that's when I started looking for a place where I belonged, where I could fit in, where I could be comfortable. And as I look back now, I realize that what I wanted really was for somebody, someplace, even if it was by mistake, to come up to me and take my hand and say, "I'm glad you're here." Because, you see, I began to think I was nobody, that I didn't belong, I didn't fit in, and I was absolutely alone. I know they talk about the lonesomeness of the alcoholic, but I don't think it compares to the lonesomeness of the non-alcoholic, because at least some of the time they're anesthetized. I wasn't. I felt every single solitary pain, real or imaginary. And it was as intense as anything that you could expect to find in a person that was in that shape. A girl in Al-Anon one time said to me, "Winnie, didn't it ever occur to you that if you had walked up to somebody else and put your hand out and said, 'I'm glad you're here,' it would have had the same effect?" Well, it never occurred to me. Because, you see, I spent a lifetime being afraid of you. I was afraid that I wasn't going to measure up to what I thought you thought I ought to be. And so I built a wall, and I damn near died of loneliness behind it. I don't suppose that there's anything to equal or to describe the feeling of frozen emotions. You can't laugh, you can't cry. You're just numb from the inside out. But we finally got to Westchester, which was kind of a blessing in disguise because it was there that Eddie was involved in a minor accident and he ended up in jail. And, of course, I moved immediately to get away from the stigma of being married to that ex-convict. And when the judge said 7 days, that's what he became as far as I was concerned. And went back to Culver City and I decided I was just going to have to leave him. Now, I did not hate him. And I realized he was losing one of his more valued possessions. But by the same token, I couldn't stand it any longer. And so I decided to write him a Dear John letter and memorize it and then sort of just, you know, toss it off when he got out of jail. And he helped, whether he knows it or not, with the composition because every night he'd call me on the phone and invite me down to Lincoln Heights to have chop suey with him and the other guy that was polishing the police cars and the guy with the gun that was watching him. And I used to think, who does he think he married that I would associate with those kind of people? Of course, I never thought of that slob polishing police cars. I used to think of a tall, handsome, professional man polishing the police cars, you know. Now, there's nothing wrong with that, except my husband isn't tall. And handsome, he might argue about. But the point I'm trying to get across to you is I don't think I saw the man I married until I sobered up. You see, I married a dream. And I tried to make him fit the mold of the dream that I had. And I read that book about a good wife does this and a good husband does this and all this, that, and the other thing, you know. Well, I did everything a good wife was supposed to do, but I couldn't get the good husband to do anything. And so in order to make the good wife look good, I had to do what the good husband usually did. And before long, I didn't know what I was, a good wife or a good husband. It just got too involved. But anyhow, he got 2 days off for being such a good polisher, which may be where the dusting started. But I wasn't really ready for him, but he wasn't willing to wait the extra 2 days. So I went down to Lincoln Heights. I did not go in. I sat across the street like I was doing charity work for the Red Cross. And when he came out of that jail, I wish you could have seen him. He looked like he'd been on a Florida vacation. I found out they let him go up on the deck, you know, and sun during the daytime. I look like I've been locked in the closet, but I've been writing for 5 days, you understand? And he opened the door. He didn't say, how are you? How are the kids? How have you been? He said, Winnie, I have seen the light. I will never take another drink as long as I live. And I forgot the whole speech because I knew that if I had polished police cars for 5 days, I would never take another drink. And you can believe me, I wouldn't. But you see, that's one of the mistakes I made all my life. I was waiting for him to say the things I would say. I was waiting for him to do the things I would do. I was waiting for him to feel the way I would feel. And he's never going to do that because he's not me. He's never going to see, feel, or do the things the way I would do them. Because God in his infinite wisdom chose to make each one of us from a separate mold. But I believed him to the point that I got myself a house out in Temple City. It was a beautiful house. It was really built for me in about 1898, I guess. It looked like a typical haunted house that had been waiting for a ghost that finally got there because it had built-in misery. You didn't have to leave home. You could go crazy right there. And the little old lady that took me through, of course, had gone into it as a bride, so she saw it the way it used to be. I saw it the way it was. But we had a kind of a communication, I guess. She took me down in what I suppose was the, whatever they call that thing with the sod floor, you know. It's not a basement in California. But she kind of nudged me, and she said, you know, this is a wonderful place to hide things. And I agreed with her. Of course, she was thinking of one thing, and I was thinking of something else. I figured a sharp shovel might be planting in the basement. Nobody'd ever know he was gone. But this house did contribute a great deal to my growth because it had built-in misery. And, of course, after the late show went off, that's when I used to do my housework, what there was of it, because I found a way to beat it. You just pile everything in the middle of the floor and lean the broom up against it. Now, if somebody happens to come to the front door, pick up the broom before you answer it, they don't know how long it's been there. And you can't do housework and worry at the same time, especially if you're a traveler such as I am. And but after the late show went off, that's when I used to do my housework, as I say, what there was of it, which was my washing. Because I've heard people this weekend talk about being hooked on alcohol, and I've heard them talk about being hooked on drugs, but I'll bet I got one that Lou has not got. I was hooked on a washing machine. Because I don't know how many people have ever watched a washing machine. It really gives you a great deal of comfort if you happen to be sort of sick inside. Because the damn thing just goes back and forth, back and forth. And when you least expect it, it spins, you know. And it just almost scares you to death. But it does put a little vinegar into your life. And of course, then I hung it out like everybody else, 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, whatever time it happened to be. And I don't know why my neighbors thought I was crazy. I used clothespins just like the rest of them. But it would hang all the next day, and then the next night I would bring it in and fold it up and put it in my closet of good intentions because I washed constantly, but I never ironed. My sponsor told me it was a defect of character, and I corrected it immediately. I quit washing, but I'm back working on the ironing. I don't know why I'm that way about ironing, except it's attached to something, you know. And I never could afford to be attached to anything. I had to be a free spirit that could move on a minute's notice. But anyhow, I'm not going to take you through a great deal more because I just found out today. I wish I hadn't been listening to him because all these years, I thought that it was a judge that told him about Alcoholics Anonymous. But I just found out today that it was a judge who knew about somebody who knew about Alcoholics Anonymous. But the time came when he was arrested in Santa Barbara. And he called me, and for the first time in my life, I didn't try to help him. Now, it wasn't because I didn't want to. It was because I couldn't. And my mother dared me to do anything. Consequently, he had to sit in jail until the following Monday. And at that time, he went, as I recall it, before a judge who was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he recessed his court and he took him into chambers. And to this day, I don't know what he said to him. But I do know that when he came back to Los Angeles, he told me that he was going into the hospital and do something about his drinking. Now, one of the reasons that I have never asked him what that conversation consisted of is because one of the things that was required of me when I came to Al-Anon was that I allow him the dignity to live his life the way he wants to. Now, God knows as I stand right here, right now, I hope it's never necessary for him to take another drink. Because I know what it's going to do to him. You see, I believe what you say. I believe that there is no answer but insanity or death. But even knowing this, I have to allow him the dignity to live his life the way he wants to. The strange thing about this pact, though, is that when I finally found it, that I was able to give him this freedom. I don't know how free he was, but for the first time in my life, I felt free. He went into the hospital. One of the conditions was that he attend AA. At an AA meeting, he heard of Al-Anon, and he wrote a letter to the Al-Anon central office and asked them to send someone out to see me. I'm grateful for that letter today, but at the time I resented it because I figured it was just another one of them nuts, you know. And, of course, when my sponsor came out the first time, she found the front door nailed shut. I had to. I was in no shape to cover two doors. And she went around to the back, and the car was there, and the coffee pot was boiling on the stove, and she yoo-hooed me a couple of times that she couldn't find me. And she has many times said since, you know, that's an accomplishment to hide that many people between the front door and the back door. But I'd had practice. But she went next door, and she asked this little old lady whether or not Mrs. Eddy was at home. And Miss Martin said, well, even if she is, you know, she thought I was crazy. And I resented that for a long time, too, because I never bothered that woman. Once we almost got trapped in the backyard together, and I hid in the bushes. And so I really didn't see why she should take that attitude with me. But and my kids never bothered her, you know. I mean, I didn't forbid them to go over there because I was kind of hip on child psychology at one time, and I used to reason with them. So I told them the story of Hansel and Gretel and let them make up their own minds. You want to end up in an oven? Go on over there. And but anyhow, I think that she scared Wilma because when she came back that night, she had a friend with her. And they called on me in pairs for a long time. It was sort of, you know, if she gets me, you know what to do. And one of them always stood by the door. But I don't know. I don't know how she got in. To this day, I don't know how she got in. I don't know whether I let her in or whether one of the kids let her in or what. But I used to get my kids to bed on a production basis. You know, everybody in the tub, everybody washed, everybody out, everybody dried, everybody in bed. So mother can worry. And she came between the drying and the dressing process. And all of a sudden, here's this female with a towel in her hand. And she's drying like mad, you know. And I wonder, who is she? But she seemed to know what she was doing, and she liked to dry, so I let her go ahead. I didn't want to stop her. But all the time she was drying, why, she kept talking about Alcoholics Anonymous and alcoholics and Al-Anon family groups, and I didn't know what she wanted. You know, I didn't know any of them. And then she said it. Drunks. I knew why she was there. She needed me. And besides that, she had a lot of friends that needed me, too. She told me that. And so when she asked me to go to a meeting, I agreed, because I've never denied my help to anyone, and I'm still making amends to prove it. Because my help is deadly, you know. I had friends that wouldn't tell me they were in trouble for fear I'd help them, but... Anyhow, I gave her just time enough to get home that night, and then I called her on the phone, and I told her I was very sorry, but something very important had come up, and I would be unable to attend the meeting as scheduled. Now, I hadn't done anything even unimportant for a long, long time, but I couldn't let her know that. I couldn't let her find out how unimportant I was, because if she found out, then I'd know. And that was the first chink in the armor. You see, it wasn't you that I ran from for years. It was me. Because I don't need you to make me miserable. I wouldn't let you do to me the things that I have done to myself. I went to my first meeting in Azusa, California, and I don't ever want to forget that first meeting. I don't ever want to forget what it's like out there without you. Because I walked into a room where no one asked me who I was, where I came from, what I did, what my husband did, how many children I had. All of the questions that I had never been able to answer because I was ashamed, and I didn't know what I was ashamed of. They didn't ask me because they didn't have to. They could look at me as I looked at them and know that we had both trudged the road to hell. The only thing that surprised me was that we hadn't met before because we went along the same road. Now, I won't try to tell you that Al-Anon has solved all my problems because it hasn't. But it sure made him a heck of a lot easier. And I know that one of the first meetings, speaker meetings that I ever went to, was a gal who started her talk off by saying, "My name is Fran and I love an alcoholic." And I wanted to knock her down. You know, to get stuck with one is one thing, but to have to get up there and brag about it, I just didn't think that was right. And so at the next meeting, they asked me what I thought of it, and they always encouraged us to tell the truth, so I told them. I said, "I don't think you should let the sick ones talk." So as the result, in those days they didn't have all that literature and fine stuff that they have today, so they used to take pics on the newcomers. And as a result of that rather rash statement, they gave me an assignment. I was to go home, take Eddie's hand, and say, "I love you." I said, "You're kidding." I said, "No, that's what you have to do." And so, would you believe it took me 3 months to do it? And I didn't do it then because I wanted to. I did it because them females, every time I went to that meeting, would say, "Have you done it yet?" And how do you lie when there's only a yes or no answer? You know, I just couldn't get away from it. I didn't know what they did to you if you lied anyhow. So finally, one night, more to get them off my back than any other reason, after the light was out, I just reached over and took Eddie's hand, and I said, "Eddie, I love you." And he sat right straight up in bed. You know, he thought he'd been electrocuted. And he said, "What the hell's the matter with you?" You know? Which isn't the world's most romantic statement. But the funny part of it is that, you know, it didn't hurt. For the first time in my life, it didn't hurt. It didn't hurt me that he didn't say, "And Winnie, I love you too." You know, like John Wayne and all them others always do on the Late Late Show. And I realized for the first time, no matter how many times he tells me, no matter how many times he tries to reassure me, he can never give me the answer that I'm looking for. Because, you see, I can never really be sure. The only thing I can be sure about is the way I feel about him. That is where my security lies, in the way I feel. Because, you see, I know me today better than I ever did before. And so when I stand here right now and I say to you, "My name is Winnie Eddy and I love an alcoholic," that's reality. That's where I live. And that's what you've given me. And that's why I'm grateful. I usually close my talks with one story that I tell all the time. And I don't tell it because it's going to mean anything to you, but because it reminds me from whence I came. And it's the story of a little boy who wanted his father to read him the funny papers, and he couldn't be bothered because he was watching the television or something. But the kid wouldn't let him alone. He just kept hacking, and finally he took a piece of the rotogravure section, had the world on it, and he tore it up in a bunch of little pieces, and he gave it to the kid, and he says, here, go put the world together, and I'll read you the funny papers. And in a very short time, the little boy was back. And there it was, all scotch taped together, the world, exactly the way it was supposed to be. And this wasn't a big kid, this was a little kid, and it kind of amazed the father. So I looked at the world, and he looked at the kid, and he says, how did you do that in such a hurry? And the little boy said, well, it wasn't really hard. He said, on the other side, there was a man. So I put the man together, and the world came out all right. And that is the story of my life. I came to Al-Anon like a giant jigsaw puzzle. Nothing fit. No matter how I tried, I couldn't get those pieces to go together. But one day at a time, because you cared, you have helped me put back together a few of the pieces. And because I'm willing to keep coming back, I know that someday those pieces will all fit together. There'll be a whole woman, and the world will come out all right. Thank you.